Hey, folks, thanks for checking out this week's show. And if you're new to the podcast, welcome. We missed you. Before we get to my guest, my one-man show, Paul Mercurio's Permission to Speak, is still running on Broadway. Love you guys to come. Go to telecharge.com for tickets. We have people coming up. It's an audience interactive show. They tell stories from their lives. They've been incredible. I had a woman, 83-year-old woman, as a kid, walked FDR's dog. Yep. FDR's dog, Follow, was walked by this woman. I said to her in the city, New York, because they lived in the same apartment building, and I said to the woman, when the dog would go, take care of his business, there would people, this pooper scooper pick it up. She's like, nah, you just watched where you walked. Pretty cool. She was great. I hope you can make it. Go to telecharge.com for tickets and use the code PMFAN. PMFAN, you get 50% off tickets, half price. It's really going great. We've got shows through October, November, and December now. We've added November and December. So come on, check it out and hang out. We'll have a good time. Now, I want to talk to you about one of my loyal sponsors, deepdiscount.com. Please listen up. They help me bring you the show, so it'd be great if you can support them. They're a cool company. I have a logo, Deep Discount logo, on my website, paulmercurio.com. You go there, click on my site, click on that logo. It'll take you to deepdiscount.com. You get savings on all sorts of great stuff. They got a sale for under $15 on hundreds and hundreds of classic movies like John Wayne and True Grit, or the director's cut of The Last of the Mohicans, even a collector's edition of Captain America. Yeah, that's my favorite costume. Not just on Halloween. I just like to, walk around with it sometimes. I get some looks, but I'm secure. Also, Captain Phillips, that Tom Hanks movie, great movie. Although it did ruin my plans, long-term plans to be a sea pirate. Yeah, kind of put a damper on that. Anyway, stop searching for stuff on your cable networks and all of that, the cable box and the thing. Buy shows you want to watch and own them forever. Go to deepdiscount.com. You'll find thousands of classics and hard-to-find titles. You'll also find new releases, too. Coming out this week, Dwayne Johnson in Skyscraper on DVD, 4K Ultra, and Blu-ray 3D. Buy your copy now for a great price at deepdiscount.com. Own it for extra features like audio commentary, deleted and extended scenes you just don't get when you rent. Look, support my sponsor. Go to my website, paulmercurio.com, click on deepdiscount.com, and it'll take you there, and there's all sorts of great stuff. Movies, TV shows, apparel, you name it, you got it, and then you name it. You know that saying. So click the logo on my website, deepdiscount.com, and check out some great stuff there. Oh, by the way, football season's underway, as you know. My Patriots, they got to 500. They're 2-2. I think we're clicking in. I think Bill Belichick is happy. I saw him smile for about a half a second. Either that or he stubbed his toe when he was grimacing. Probably the latter. Anyway, are you winning much? If not, there's a way to double your money that's guaranteed. BetDSI is making that possible this football season when you register with the promo code PAUL100. That's PAUL100. To help you get started with some extra bang for your buck, BetDSI is offering to double your money on your first deposit. That's right, deposit to start winning now and get up to $2,500 free. That's double your money right now from the get-go. Use promo code PAUL100. Did I mention the promo code? It's PAUL100. When it comes to football, BetDSI has odds on everything you could ever want or imagine. NFL, NCAA, MLB, anything you think of, they got, okay? So BetDSI has been online for 20 years. They're impeccable reputation. They got great service. You're ready to win. Just join BetDSI.com today using the promo code PAUL100, and you already won by doubling your bankroll straight away. That's promo code PAUL100. Get in on the action. Don't stand on the sidelines. Go to BetDSI.com. My guest this week is quite an iconic figure who has a great new book out. He has been the police commissioner of New York City. He has served at the federal level. He's served at the international level in a lot of different capacities as a law enforcement official and just someone that has been a central figure in the war on terror, even going back before 9/11, but certainly since 9/11 going forward. It's Bernard Kerik, and his book is The Grave Above the Grave, a new book out. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, sir.
Yeah, it's great to have you on. You have the book is it feels a little autobiographical in the sense that it follows Raymond, the central figure, who is a police commissioner after 9/11 and sort of dealing with issues regarding that and the politics of being a commissioner in a big city. How close is this to the bone of what you experienced?
Well, some of it, you know, the day-to-day operations of the PD is, you know, a lot of the things that I would go through, maybe not specifically, you know, exact, but sort of in the same capacity. You have, I had 55,000 people that worked for me, 41,000 uniformed officers. You know, you deal with the city council, you need to deal with the senators and congressmen, and heads of states from foreign countries, and a bunch of stuff that you would normally think, you know, a police chief or somebody in charge of a police department would never have to deal with. Mm-hmm. But in New York City, you're dealing with 12 million people on a daily basis that visits, lives, works, or visit, or goes to school in the city. And, you know, and you have the UN on top of it. So it's, it can be a pretty busy job.
Yeah. How do you balance it all? Like sort of you seem like you have to serve so many masters in that job. You just ticked off a few. Like, so how did you manage that and sort of keep your sanity?
Well, the good thing for me is I worked for Rudy Giuliani.
Right.
And, with Giuliani, there was really no political correctness. So I didn't have to worry about, you know, the politics. I didn't have to worry about political correctness. I didn't have to worry about all the things that I see today in and around the country that police executives have to deal with. I didn't have to deal with none of that. Mm. You know, I didn't, you know, Rudy Giuliani would never say, go meet with Jesse Jackson or Al Sharpton.
Mm.
You know, I want you to meet with them and,
right.
you know, have a conversation with them about our policies.
Mm-hmm.
Well, they have nothing to do with our policies, so I'm not going to meet with them. I wouldn't meet with them, and Rudy would never force me to do that. So I was pretty lucky, but you still have a big job. I mean, it's an enormous job. It's sometimes a thankless job.
Right,
but you do the best you could do under the circumstances.
Well, I can tell you that I noticed as a citizen of New York City who lived here a while now, and I lived through when Giuliani came on board. There was a stark difference in the level of safety that you felt as a average citizen. You know, perfect example is, you know, my wife and I grew up in Rhode Island, up in New England. We'd come back late at night. We'd drive into the city, get off the FDR there at 96th Street, and you get at least two or three, you know, people coming up to you at 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning trying to, you know, intimidate you to wash your windshield and intimidating you. And that
yeah.
might sound like a small thing, but like, you know, the quality of life got better under Giuliani and you because, you know, there was a lack of attention to, I almost felt like, and maybe this gets to what you're saying about political correctness, we were bending so back over backwards to accommodate the feelings and rights of everybody else that the feelings and the rights of the average person, law-abiding citizen, were being forgotten.
Well, you know, this is almost like a setup question because you use 96th and the FDR Drive, and this will explain exactly why things changed.
Mm.
Rudy Giuliani used to get off at that exit,
mm-hmm.
and I don't care if it was 10 o'clock at night or 1 o'clock in the morning or 2 a.m., he would call me, personally call me, if there was somebody there, you know, stopping cars, squeegeeing windows, you know, graffiti, whatever, he would personally call
wow.
me.
Wow.
And it happened about 3 times before I actually called the precinct commander and had him come there. And I said, the next time the mayor calls me, I'm going to put a van on this corner, and that's going to be your office. That's where you're going to work. You're going to work right in the van. That's where your precinct is going to be if I get another call. And I can promise you I got no more calls from the mayor, but that shows you the detail that the mayor, you know, focused on this stuff. He wanted the city cleaned up,
yeah.
and he wanted it cleaned up from bottom to top, top to bottom.
Yeah, you know, and it's really, and you know, and I know you're not coming at it from a political standpoint, but obviously being mayor, he does, and would, and I would too. it's pretty basic. Like, pick up our garbage, keep our taxes reasonable, and keep us safe, and we'll elect you forever. You know what I mean? Like, it's not a complicated formula. And I just couldn't get over how, you know, it took that long for someone to figure out, like, you know, make us feel safe. You know, make me feel like I want to walk around the neighborhood past 9 o'clock at night. And it was a stark difference after he came in. And I understand that, you know, some of his tactics or approaches maybe push buttons, but, you know, it's sort of like you're dealing with human beings. So you're going to break a few eggs here and there. You can't make everybody happy 100% of the time. You know?
Yeah. But you know what? The bottom line is, and look around the country today and you will see a stark difference in urban cities where there is major violence, corruption, you know, murder, mm-hmm. the murder rates, and people yet, even 25 years after Giuliani, they have yet to understand how to change it. And he said, you know, the Renaissance of New York City was a clear example of how to do it, but everybody's stuck on political correctness. Mm-hmm. Everybody's stuck on, you know, well, this area is poverty-stricken, and it's, you know, there's socioeconomic issues, and there's, you know, racial issues. Well, that's all nonsense.
Right.
And the reason it's nonsense is because it's going to remain poverty-stricken, and there's going to remain all these socioeconomic issues because nobody is coming to build businesses, start jobs, work, visit, live, and go to sleep and go to school in a place where they're not safe.
Right, right.
So the first and foremost thing you have to do is reduce the crime.
Yeah.
And in New York City, for every percentage point we reduced violent crime and murder, I could show you increases in economic development, mm-hmm. real estate value, and tourism.
Mm. Yeah.
That's it.
Yeah.
It's a simple solution. Mm. You just have to have the courage to do it.
Right. And people are afraid of alienating voters and all of that. And so,
exactly.
Yeah, and it ends up, you worked undercover in the narcotics in New York City. And where are you on like these clean needle programs and that kind of thing? Do you think that that's a good idea, or is that just us sort of throwing our hands up and saying, well, we can't figure, if you can't beat them, join them?
That's basically giving up.
Yeah.
And that's my opinion. That's my own personal opinion.
Mm-hmm.
And I look at this from a very different perspective because I lived in that world as an undercover for 4.5 years. I started investigations on the streets of New York City and wound up in the jungles of Guatemala, Costa Rica, Brazil, Ecuador, and Colombia. I know what this stuff does to you. I know what it does to society. I'm not for anything else that would create addictions or help them kill themselves, help people kill themselves. So I'm totally against it personally.
Yeah. So in writing the book and sort of talking about 9/11 and the political correctness, and I feel it too as a performer and a comedian, just it, there's always this pushback of be careful what you say and how you say it, and you can't walk on eggshells. So if 9/11 happened today with the nature of political correctness, how much more difficult would it be for law enforcement to do its job post the 9/11 event if it were to happen today, given the nature of how sort of politically correct we are right now?
You know, that's a really good question because it ties into the world we're living in today.
Mm.
But the sad thing is, it would be no problem at all. You know why? Because all these politically correct people that have come about in the last 17 years, on 9/11, they were standing down on the West Side Highway, God bless America, God bless the New York City Police Department, go get them, George Bush. They were scared to death.
Mm.
And you know what? Sometimes that's what it takes.
Yeah.
So right now, you've got this politically correct world, you got this leftist movement going on, but when the stuff hits the fan, all those people are nowhere to be found, and they're the first ones calling the cops and calling the first responders.
Mm-hmm.
So I can promise you, if it happened today, we'd be back where we were 17 years ago.
Yeah. In the book, you know, obviously you draw parallels in a way to your life and experiences and to just and, you know, obviously terrorism. So what is it, if anything, that you're trying to say or establish, other than obviously being a great read? What were you hoping to sort of get across?
I think to make people understand what the possibilities are that could happen today. As you read the book, there are, you know, different events that happen, mm-hmm. Involving the police commissioner, involving terrorism, and you get to see how this threat emanates. You get to see what they think, how they communicate, how they acquire weapons, what their plans are, mm-hmm. why they make the plans they do, and how the police department has a job that a lot of people just don't understand. Like I said, you know, you don't want nothing to do with the police until you need the police.
Right.
And then all of a sudden it's a different change of atmosphere.
Right. How where are we in the chess game, right? So they make a move, we make a move, they make a move, we make a move. You don't hear much of Al-Qaeda right now in the news or ISIS, but obviously it's out there. In sort of an overall sense, and I know it's a big question, but like what channels are they using now? What are their tactics now in terms of what you're seeing and what you understand to be sort of how they're playing this game, given how aggressive we've been as a nation and in New York on anti-terrorism?
Basically, what they're looking at now is a lot of this lone wolf stuff.
Mm.
My concern was and is, when people ask me, you know, what do I think about, I'm worried about lone wolves, but I'm worried also about communication, spontaneous stuff, you know, where these guys can communicate where they never have before. And, you know, do I expect another 9/11, four planes flying into buildings? No. But I would not put it past them to put a series of attacks, coordinated attacks together, four or five different cities at one time, two or three shooters in each city. Same time, same day. You know, what if they went into an elementary school and killed 50 kindergarten kids in each city? You know what that would do to our country?
Mm.
And it's very feasible.
And is it
so
the idea?
You have to look at what they do abroad when they go into cities in, you know, in their own countries, Iraq, Syria, Afghanistan.
Mm-hmm.
How do they attack them? They walk into a mosque. They, you know, a suicide bomber. Could they go into churches here? Could they go into a mosque here?
Right.
These are the things that I think about.
And when you say instant communication, what do you mean by that?
Well, they have a mechanism to communicate today where they never had before, through social media, these encrypted apps. There's ways for them to communicate that is extremely difficult for us to get through. So it's extremely important for us to have the best intelligence capabilities we can, you know, in our communications, local, state, and federal authorities, working in conjunction with the international authorities. That kind of stuff is extremely important.
Mm-hmm. You served in Saudi Arabia, worked in Saudi Arabia on a couple of different occasions in other parts of that world. What did you take? Obviously, it had to help and be a learning curve in a way in terms of how maybe to approach things here in terms of anti-terrorism and safety and security. Like what stood out for you or stands out for you in terms of how they approach things there vis-a-vis, you know, terrorism and preventing terrorism?
Well, look, for years, many of the countries there, they ignored it or they paid these people off. What I would go by today is I would focus on the King of Jordan and President el-Sisi of Egypt. These are two guys that lead two countries, devout Muslims, both of them, but they're both former military commanders. The King of Jordan, King Abdullah II, is the former Special Forces Commander for Jordan. And, you know, when I worked for this guy for 4.5 years, when people say, what's he like? I say, he's the Arab version of Rambo, you know, because he pretty much, you know, that's exactly what he is. So, you know, he's a devout Muslim.
Mm-hmm.
He's a good man. He's a gracious man, a dynamite guy, but he despises the radical Islamic movement.
Mm-hmm.
He despises these people who he calls the outlaws of Islam, people that have hijacked the Quran and use the religion as a sort of a stepping stool to go out and commit jihad and mass murder. Mm. So I would look at those guys. That's the people, you know, when I think the president is looking at strategies, if I was him, I'd call these two guys in a room and say, okay, here's what we're doing. We're going to put together a strategy to do this. You guys lead the charge. I'll get you the resources, and let's go kill these guys. Mm-hmm. That's it. Mm-hmm. You know, there's no diplomatic solutions here.
Right.
You're not going to talk these people into changing their mind.
Right.
So you're going to kill them, or they're going to kill us. I'd just rather kill them first.
It's almost similar to Perez's approach in the with regard to Entebbe, you know, sort of, and...
No, exactly. You know, exactly.
You got to go in, and there's no talking. And especially going circling back to the political correctness and the environment we live in is sort of, if you have that approach, you're viewed as a barbarian or in some way or whatever. And it's like, and sometimes talking, people just don't understand that talking doesn't, often we hope it does, but sometimes it just doesn't accomplish anything, and you have to act. And that's why a job like you've had over the years cannot be an easy job. I mean, on top of which, you know, you had to do rebuilding, you know, Operation Iraqi Freedom. George Bush appointed you interim to Interior Minister of Iraq. And you basically had to rebuild that infrastructure while, I guess, training these people as well. What was that like? I mean, that just seems like it's so overwhelming a task.
Well, listen, rebuilding the interior is one thing because, you know, you're looking for resources and money and all this other stuff. Mm. It's the retraining that is an issue. I mean, a real issue. You know, you're going from guys that, you know, their view of a prisoner interrogation is hanging a guy upside down by his feet and smacking him on the bottom of his feet until his feet bleed or pulling out his toenails. That's their idea of interrogating someone.
Right.
So you have to change their mindset,
right,
to get them to understand the principles of international policing, if you will.
Mm.
And that is not that easy. It's a difficult job to do.
Were they, I would imagine, was their level of intelligence capability fairly nuanced, or was that an area where you had to make them be more sophisticated in terms of retrieving intelligence and interpreting it and all of that?
Well, it really depends on, you know, where they came from, how educated they were, you know, their tribal issues, their religious issues. There's a whole bunch of stuff involved. But if you are the right leaders, you know, I had an Iraqi general that worked for me who was absolutely phenomenal. You let them pick the people. You let them make
right.
that decision, and they'll make the right one and bring in the right people.
Right.
You know, and then you got to just take it from there.
Yeah. You talked about Giuliani making phone calls in the middle of the night. You were very hands-on when you were commissioner, too. You would cruise the city with a security detail, right? And sort of just keep an eye on
things. I mean, I always had a security detail, but, you know, on certain nights, if my schedule was slow, for example, like on a Friday night, usually it would be on a Friday night. If I didn't have anything to do, we would dress down and my, you know, security guys, my advance guys, guys from my office, we take 3 or 4 cars and go out on patrol.
This is how you spend a Friday night off? You don't go to a movie or go bowling? Jesus. You got
No. I'd go, you know, looking around the city.
Yeah.
You know, ironically, you know, I think I made 5 or 6 arrests.
I read that while you were commissioner, right?
While I was commissioner, somebody wanted for murder and carjacking and a whole bunch of stuff. But, you know, look, I was a very aggressive cop when I was a cop.
Mm.
So when I became police commissioner, you know, I remember the mayor, that one event, the mayor said to me the next morning, he says, you know, what were you doing? I said, I was out on patrol.
Mm.
He said, for what? I said, well, that's what cops do. I said, you know, and he burst out laughing. He said, you're the commissioner. I said, yeah, I know, but I'm still a cop. And, you know,
yeah.
It's also good. You know, it's a leadership trait that I think is good because it sends a message to your men and women in the field. you're not going to ask them to do anything you wouldn't do.
Yeah.
And I've done it, so...
Well, this has been your life. I mean, you were, what, 19, 20, and you went into the military in 1974, I believe. What is it about the military, law enforcement? Obviously, this is not just a job for you, it's a passion. What is it that clicked for you at a young age about this, you think?
Well, you know what? For me, I grew up in a rough place. I had a less than humble, upbringing. Mm-hmm. I was abandoned by my mother when I was three. She was actually beaten to death and murdered when I was 9 years old. I quit high school. I went to Eastside High in Paterson, New Jersey, which is the only thing it's known for is violence and being depicted in a major motion picture called Lean on Me. So that was my upbringing. And if it wasn't for, I think, the martial arts, I got into martial arts early when I was young because I had to learn how to fight. And
other than fighting, what did that do for you? Did it give you discipline? Did it give you something to focus on?
You know what it does
for
you? It teaches you discipline and respect. Hmm. And I think between the martial arts and the military, that was what catapulted my career. That's what sent me on the route that I was. Otherwise, I think I would have stayed in Paterson and wound up getting in a lot of trouble. But the military gave me a sense of discipline, respect, mm-hmm. a mission, and it was something I enjoyed. So from that point on, my life was on its way, and I did okay. Mm.
How do you work 4.5 years undercover in narcotics and that, and I mean this half kidding, but half serious, and not have a nervous breakdown? Like, how do you keep those worlds separate, and what is the key to surviving as an undercover officer and coming out the other side okay, either literally alive or mentally just okay as well?
Listen, I was just going to say, the key is, you know, you're talking, I was an undercover from 1988 to 1992 or three or something like that. Mm. In my areas, I was in Manhattan North Narcotics, which is Harlem, Spanish Harlem, or Washington Heights.
Wow.
So yeah, you would go, you know, I had hair. Well, I'm bald now, but I actually had hair at one point. And it was down to the middle of my back. I had 7 diamond earrings and a big goatee. Mm. And, you know, I was a white boy buying drugs in Harlem and Spanish Harlem. So the key to your success is staying alive. And back then, that was no joke. I've had guns stuck in my face, in my stomach. You know, I've had partners shot and wounded. I've had partners shot and killed, many of them back in those days in New York. This was the height of the crack epidemic. Being an undercover in the NYPD is a rough job because you pretty much, you know, there's no gun, no shield, no vest, no nothing. Mm. And you're stuck in these tenement buildings up in Harlem or, you know, Washington Heights, and you're there to buy drugs, and there's some bad people around.
But you also have to be, I don't mean this in a demeaning way, but you have to be a good salesman in the sense that, like, you've got to convince these bad guys that you're one of them. You have to get, you have to gain their trust. You have to keep their trust.
Well, listen, there's a,
how do you do that?
All kind of stuff. You know, there's actually classes when you go to, when you, you know, get transferred to plainclothes and go to one of these undercover things, they'll tell you all kind of things on how to get in and how to get, you know, to do what you got to do and get out. And I'll give you one example of creative art for an undercover.
Right.
I was up in Harlem, and there was a spot that used to sell heroin on 110th Street, Lexington Avenue. And everybody knew about it, but when you went in there, they'd stick a gun on you and they'd hold the gun on you until you bought your stuff and left. So I would go to that spot. Before I get there, I would find dog manure poop, mm-hmm. and I would rub it all over the back of my legs, and I would smell really bad. And I'd walk into this building, and I'd get up in line to go buy my stuff, and everybody'd be like, "What is that? What is that smell? Where's it coming from?" And they would move my behind to the front of the line. I'd get my stuff and get out.
Oh my God!
And you know, it was a way for me to, you know, skip the search and the questions and all this other stuff.
Yeah.
There's all kind of stuff that you could do.
Unbelievable. That's your next book, I think, right there. My Life in Poop. That's the name of the book right there.
Yeah.
It's a really fascinating life. And just in reading up on you a bit, and it's just your life alone is just a really, really unbelievable journey from being a kid in New Jersey to, you know, rebuilding Iraq. That's pretty heady stuff. The book is a really great read. And I encourage people, where can people get it right now? It's out everywhere, I would imagine, right? And
everywhere, Amazon, Barnes and Noble, you name it, your local bookstores.
Okay.
But it's doing well.
Yeah. It's The Grave Above the Grave. It's Bernie Kerik. And it's really great to have you on, and I might reach out to you in the future just to have you on again, just to talk about other things, because it's really, really great.
Thank you, sir.
And thanks for cleaning the city up. You made my life better and my wife's life better, so I appreciate the work.
Thank you.
Okay, so my guest is Bernard Kerik. The book is The Grave Above the Grave. Go read it, and there's other great books he's written as well. Thanks for being on, Bernie.
Thank you.
All right, that was Bernard Kerik. Very cool guy. Pretty intense. I'd like to put him and Bill Belichick in a room together and see who blinks first. Hey, don't forget my one-man show on Broadway, Permission to Speak. It's going great. We've added dates in November and December. People are really enjoying it. Come see one if you live near New York City. We're right in Times Square. Or if you're visiting the city, come spend an hour, hour and a half, hang out. Go to telecharge.com. For tickets, use the code PMFAN. That's PMFAN. You get 50% off. Thanks for checking out the podcast, folks. We'll see you next week.